Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Last week, Avera Health and the Hazelton Betty Ford Foundation hosted the 6th annual Avera and Hazelton Betty Ford Foundation Symposium in downtown Sioux Falls. The symposium addressed the impact of the current opioid epidemic and discussed evidence-based solutions. In response to the opioid epidemic, Dr. Marvin Seppala and Hazelton Betty Ford developed the Comprehensive Opioid Response with the 12 Steps program, which combines traditional methods of treatment with medication to help treat those addicted to opioids. We're joined now on the phone by Dr. Seppala. He's a nationally recognized expert on the opioid crisis, and he joins us now on the phone. Dr. Seppala, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
We'll have Dr. Matt Stanley with Avera joining us in just a moment. But let's start with you, because I'm curious, as I look back at your history, your personal history and professional history, I'm wondering how quickly is our understanding of addiction disorders really evolving?
You know, when I first decided to work in addiction back in the mid-80s, as I was leaving medical school, I was told by one of my attendings at the Mayo Medical School that I was throwing away a good career in medicine. So things have changed dramatically. You know, now it is a good career. I have a great career, and others are entering this field. And it's advanced remarkably because of the brain sciences, really. We have a much better understanding of what addiction does to change our brains, or how our brains are changed genetically even prior to addiction, which is the primary risk for addiction. So it's a much different field. We have much more resources and different ways of helping people.
Talk about a little bit of looking at some of the traditional methods of approaching addiction treatment, you know, without medication, a traditional 12-step program, and the complexities of really getting people to understand that there's a way to do things differently.
Well, you know, we opened our organization in 1949, and at that point in time, there wasn't even medications used for alcohol detoxification. If one of our patients was going to have a seizure, a nurse would put a tongue depressor between his teeth so he wouldn't crack his teeth. So this is how far we've gone in a relatively short period of time. And we started out with a real 12-step focus because the only thing recognized in the United States to help folks with alcoholism or alcohol use disorders was 12-step programs, Alcoholics Anonymous, basically. And it was just kind of a bright light in the field, because all of a sudden there was something that could be done for people. And that became, partly because of our involvement, the model for addiction treatment for the country. More recently, you know, let's say the last 20, 30 years, there's been a great deal of research going on the brain sciences side, and that included trying to figure out medications as well as psychotherapies specific for addiction. And some really dramatic changes have occurred with adding psychotherapies during the course of addiction treatment that were organized and evidence-based and really well-studied, such as cognitive behavioral therapy and motivational interviewing or motivational enhancement therapies. And they also found that actually the 12-step programs worked quite well when they compared those two therapies to 12-step programs. So they were proven to be effective in the literature too. And the combination can make a really big difference. Then we started to have a focus on brain science and potential medications. And it started with Anabuse for alcoholism, which is a difficult medication because it has a real adverse response. People get a really flushing reaction in their face and body, and they vomit if they drink while they take this medication. So it's not something you want to kind of do to people very often, and it went out of favor overall. But now we have two other medications, naltrexone and acamprosate for alcohol dependence, and we have three medications for the opioid use disorders. That's methadone, which has been around since the 60s, buprenorphine, which has been available now for almost 20 years, and naltrexone, which actually blocks opioid receptors. So if people use opioids, they can't even get intoxicated.
Are there reservation, like what are some of the challenges of you know, sort of convincing people that treatment modalities have changed, that medication has a place in you know, dealing with opioid addiction? You've had to convince people in the past that there's a way to move forward, haven't you?
We sure have, Lori. It's been a bit of a difficult road that way. In fact, when we first announced that we were going to start using medications in addition to psychotherapies and 12-step involvement for people with opioid use disorders or opioid dependence, we had a huge backlash from the field itself, from other providers and other treatment centers who said we were, you know, going down the wrong path and we were ruining, you know, addiction treatment and our whole heritage and things like that. And as well as colleagues of mine around the country that work in addiction medicine telling us the same sort of thing, that we were, you know, we were making a big mistake. And yet now these medicines are recognized as the norm and the right way to go about this in combination with the other therapies. And it's hard, I think, because in the addiction field, so many of the providers of addiction treatment, whether they're counselors, psychologists, or medical providers, have their own history of addiction and recovery, and often enough will tend to just use their own experience as the primary means that they treat their patients. And that's just not adequate. And I can say that because of my experience. As an adolescent, I had addiction and dropped out of high school and actually ended up at Hazelden, where I work now, which is kind of unusual. And in going through my training, my medical training, starting with medical school, then my psychiatric training at the University of Minnesota with an addiction fellowship, I started to learn that there's a lot of ways that people get sober, a lot of ways to address this illness, and a lot of different things people do around the world in different countries. And I started to study the brain sciences as well as those psychotherapies. And I've kept up with that. And my bias is that this is a very complex, very difficult disease to treat. And by complex, it has biological, psychological, social, and even spiritual manifestations, behaviorally and in brain function. And if that's the case, we can't just have a simple solution. There's really, like, it's like dealing with a very new or very difficult cancer. You can't just say, well, we'll just try this one treatment. You have to combine treatments and do whatever you possibly can to help that individual and save their lives. And that's how I see our treatment of addiction, that it's now, especially with this opioid crisis, revealing itself as a real fatal problematic illness, even to the point that it's reduced the age expectation here in the United States, that we don't live as long because of there's so many deaths from addiction compared to what we used to. It's actually decreasing. And if we can examine it that way as a national crisis, not just the opioid crisis, but the whole addiction crisis itself, and do whatever we can to treat it, combining therapies and enlisting the whole healthcare system, we have a lot better chance of succeeding and helping a lot more people.
I'm going to bring Dr. Matt Stanley into the conversation. He's a psychiatrist with Avera, vice president of Avera's Behavioral Health. He's joining me in the Sioux Falls studio. Dr. Stanley, first talk a little bit about this connection between Hazelden, Betty Ford, and Avera Health, if you would, please.
Absolutely, Laura. Hi, Marv. Good to talk to you again.
Hey, man.
We were just together at as you mentioned, our relationship. Marv and I just had the opportunity to work together at the Avera Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation annual symposium. So it's just one of the ways that we have found to connect with Hazelden to enhance our treatment and kind of broaden their coalition of treatment facilities or those interested in the treatment of addiction. But our relationship goes back several years. Of course, we've been a reference or a referral point to Hazelden Betty Ford, even before it was Hazelden Betty Ford, and it was just Hazelden. And of course, Betty Ford and the foundation was well known on the West Coast. But we've been referring patients there for years. And as we look at our history, there's a lot of parallels. Started relatively small in response to a critical need and has a religious affiliation, is really focused on mission. And as I said, we referred so many patients, we felt we needed to get to know them. And the longer we worked with them and began to develop our own plans, and as Marv was kind of referring to earlier, even we as a health system began to kind of evolve our understanding of addictions and the health care and the need to provide addiction care. As that evolved, we just wanted a better understanding and a better relationship with our treatment providers. And Hazleton was obviously one of the premier, if not the premier, providers in the entire world. So that relationship for us, we always try to seek out the best when we want to learn and create a relationship with someone. So it was natural for us to move toward that relationship with Hazleton and Betty Ford.
Dr. Stanley, we've talked a lot on this program. You've joined us before. Others have joined us to talk about access in South Dakota to mental health services. But I want to focus today a little bit on the individuality of the treatment and then what happens afterwards, because it's about more than access. You could spend time and really be all in on your treatment and then come back to a town in rural South Dakota and what's next. So tell me a little bit about Avera's efforts to sort of deal with that part of life living with addiction disorder.
Yeah, you bring up a fantastic point. Well, well identified, because that's, I think, one of the areas where we failed. When I say we, I think it's, as a healthcare system, maybe even as a country, that the model that had, at least I think, gained the most momentum and probably funding early in treatment, and Dr. Spala can speak to this better than I, but it really is kind of that intense 28-day focus. And then follow-up wasn't entirely lacking, but it probably wasn't as intense as what we now understand it needs to be. But follow-up was almost always dependent on, your local AA or later NA group. So it was, more centered around a peer support network that would develop in your community. That has some drawbacks, as you say, when you get into the more rural areas, when just getting around at this time of the year can be incredibly difficult. One of the key components of AA, of course, is anonymity. I've talked to many people that are trying to work through their recovery, and they're uncomfortable when virtually everybody in the town knows who you are and everything about you and your family, and adds another layer, I think, of difficulty to that concept of recovery. So I think one of the things that we are trying to develop in concert with developing our new treatment facility is the idea that for 12 months after that high intensity period, we want to follow through with you and provide support that really will connect back to those that you recovered with, so your therapist and counselor. And then we also hope to kind of keep together a cohort of people that recovered together, because I think peer support remains critical. Now, we still need to use the resources in the community, so we would still utilize AA or NA and those programs. So it's enhancing that support and, really taking more of a chronic disease management approach rather than maybe just a willpower or self-control, I think is how much of the populace looks at how we need to recover from addictions. So we've really embraced the medical model as well. And as Marv said, it's a very complex disease, maybe one of the most complex we deal with. But the idea that it is a disease, just that word and applying it to an addiction, is really world-changing for many people. You really have to shift your paradigm, and you really have to look at this illness in a different way than most have throughout the course of their life.
Dr. Seppala, talk a little bit about the brain science, if you will. And, we make a comparison to a disease like cancer. Now, when people get a diagnosis, it's not just, and then you will have radiation. There's gene sequencing of a tumor, and there's this really deep individual treatment. And how does that apply to what we know about addiction disorders and finding out what, how individual does it have to be, and how do you look at it, as Dr. Stanley was saying, as sort of a chronic lifetime, illness that needs certain, needs who knows what, depending on the individual situation?
Well, Matt's absolutely right. We have to take a chronic disease management approach in that this is a lifelong illness that relapse is common, especially early on within the first 12 to 18 months, but it can occur at any point. And now and then I meet people, in fact, just recently, someone who'd been abstinent for over 20 years, starting in her adolescence, and suddenly had a relapse. And her father died, and in response to that sort of grief reaction, found herself suddenly using drugs and alcohol again. And after that length of time, just shocked by that, didn't really recognize it coming, and had difficulty getting to the resources necessary to address it. And one of the things that we understand is that there's two primary brain areas involved. The reward center of our brains, which are primarily responsible for survival itself, that survival of species by sexual behavior, eating, drinking, human interaction, that sort of thing, is rewarded there, and that's the top priority of that part of the brain. But it also is responsible for other pleasurable and rewarding things that we enjoy as humans, and whether it's really good chocolate, really good food, or skiing, that sort of thing. But the primary responsibility is keeping us alive, and unfortunately, all the drugs of abuse and alcohol and tobacco affect that same part of the brain and do so in a real adverse way, and reprioritize how that part of the brain works so that for those that become addicted, the number one priority gets switched around, and it's no longer survival. It's now continued drug use. And anyone that's been around addiction and you see all these overdose deaths understand that in the midst of addiction, people risk their lives to continue use. It's very common, and not in early addiction, but certainly in middle to late stages of addiction. The other part of the brain involved is the prefrontal cortex, where we actually think things through, plan things out, figure out a problem, do something about it, those sorts of executive functions that drive our everyday decision making. And that part of the brain is also dysfunctional, and those with addiction, to the point that they don't really see the problem fully and have limited resources to plan out, solutions and strategies to address it. So that we've got this excessive drive. Suddenly, the continued use of substance is way more important than life itself, and the part of the brain that should figure it out can't do so. And so laboratories in academic medical centers and within the federal government have been trying to use that information to develop other means of addressing addiction. The National Institute of Drug Abuse, their primary focus for the last 10 years or so has been on finding new medications, and they've done that to a degree, and there's a lot more work going on. But there's also other types of research. When we talk about different types of science, and they aren't available yet for patients, but there's vaccines that have been made for nicotine, for cocaine, and for opioids. Mm-hmm. And these vaccines, like you would get a polio vaccine in childhood, would prevent you from getting high if you took those substances. Now, right now, they're just doing animal studies. They've started some human studies, but vaccines only last a few weeks to a couple of months. They're not useful yet, but they think someday they'll figure that out. And then there'll be some ethical questions of whether you should give those to your children or not. Of course, it'll be fraught with some difficulties and a lot of discussion, but we'll figure it out at some point when they become available. And then even related to the cancer field, there's certain cancers that respond to increasing enzymes of our own that already occur naturally, that are developed by our own cells. And they increase these enzymes by introducing a virus into the person. That virus goes into their body's cells and introduces a certain genetic material that alters how those cells function, increasing the amount of an enzyme that can fight off the cancer. And that's working in certain cancers right now and being given to humans for cancers. And recently some folks at Mayo talked to me about developing something similar, because most of the drugs of abuse get metabolized by enzymes in our bodies that respond to those substances. And yet, like the enzyme that breaks down or metabolizes cocaine is in our systems in a low amount. And when cocaine is introduced into a person's body, it slowly but surely degrades it and gets rid of it. So they wondered what would happen if you enhanced that enzyme in the same way as they do with these viruses for cancer. And they did it in rats, and it worked just fine. The rats didn't get intoxicated from the cocaine, because by increasing that enzyme, it broke it down before it got to the brain. So there's all kinds of things that are coming. We're going to see dramatic changes in how we view the treatment of addiction. And we're going to have to be really careful at the same time. Like any advances in medicine, we got to make good decisions about how these things are used.
That just blew my mind. That whole, I was like, what? And then what? And then what?
It's amazing. It's just
such a low-key delivery for such a revolutionary concept. Dr. Stanley, we were talking with Dr. Seppala about this notion of a time when, you know, even people within your own industry are criticizing, you know, like, you can't do this, you're going to wreck it, really strong words and controversy. And I'm wondering, as Avera, and really you have been so generous with your time with South Dakota Public Broadcasting and other, to really sort of talk about what Avera is doing, talk about what the future of addiction treatment in South Dakota can be. Do you experience a similar, like, we're sitting at this time where there is pushback and it's just education, education, education? Or do you feel like we're kind of past that and now it's just, we need resources, how fast can you get it done?
Well, I think we've made progress. To say we're past it might be too optimistic, even for me.
I'm an optimist.
So I think that I don't get a lot of pushback within the medical community. I think what gets interesting, though, is you can find areas where everything becomes a little controversial, and Dr. Seppala could talk probably very well about some of the studies that have used, let's say, methadone or Subutex or Suboxone with prisoners to treat their addiction so that when they come out, they're not as subject or as at risk for overdose or possibly for recidivism. But as you can imagine, using an opioid-like drug to treat someone who's in prison for drug-related crimes or crimes that could be traced back to drugs is very controversial. So that's an area that will continue to be controversial, I think, no matter what. I think just the idea that you can use a drug, a substitute medication, for instance, to treat an addiction is very difficult for many people, because to them, you are not really treating the problem. You are just kind of putting a patch on things and allows somebody's life to go on. If you look at the studies, however, it's very powerful that treating with a substitute medication like Suboxone versus not treating, the risk of death, and the risk of other very bad outcomes goes up significantly with the attempt at just pure abstinence versus medication treatment. So there's a lot of areas that remain controversial. And just as Dr. Seppala said, you know, even back and currently, many people who were very strong or are very strong adherents to 12-step, even have issues sometimes with the idea that psychotropic medications for things like anxiety or depression are questionable in the use of people who are in recovery. So we have a long way to go. I think the biggest bias, if you will, that we have to overcome is just the idea that addiction somehow don't fit into the category of a medical illness that require treatment and require the same kind of resources and commitment to treatment that we give to other medical illnesses.
Right. Because, Dr. Sepala, if you fully accept that and then you think about the idea of withholding a medication that could help someone with a disease, that becomes, as one of our previous guests from NOVA said, a human rights issue. If you know someone has a disease and you refuse to give them medication, there are some doctors who are speaking out about that very, very strongly right now in Canada. So I will never get to the bottom of my questions about this, but we are at the bottom of our time. So I'm going to have to let you go and invite you both back anytime that you're willing to join us. Dr. Marvin Sepala is with the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Sepala.
Really glad to, and I appreciate you bringing attention to these issues.
Dr. Matt Sanley with Avera Health, Vice President of Avera's Behavioral Health. Always a pleasure. I know how busy you are. Thank you for coming down to the studio.
I really appreciate it, Lori, and it was good to be able to touch base with Marvin.